Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. Our first story today comes to us from Alton Takeyama Chung, who tells all kinds of stories connected to his eclectic heritage. He has Hawaiian, Japanese, and Korean roots. And sometimes that means Polynesian folk tales, and sometimes it means wonderful Asian ghost stories. But Alton also makes a careful study of wartime historical stories, stories of individuals who witnessed some of the most difficult events in the living memory of the world. Alton turns those experiences into stories to tell on stage, and he performs them in the character and the voice of the people who live them. This is one of those stories. It's the story of a Holocaust survivor named Solly Ganor, and Alton calls Solly's story the twice-saved life. Solly's life is saved once in wartime when he's a boy, and then many years later, his spirit is revived again, his life saved, when his wartime experiences come back to him in an unforgettable way. Here's Alton Takeyama Chung, recorded live in the Appleseed Studio with The Twice-Saved Life.
We Jews have a saying, to save one life is as if to save the entire world. Kaunas, Lithuania, it's just a dot on the map for most Americans, but it's where I grew up. Now, I was 11 years old when Hitler invaded Poland from the west in September 1939. 2 weeks later, Russia invaded Poland from the east, and soon thousands of these Polish Jews were fleeing across the border into Lithuania. And like all the other Lithuanian children, I gave my Hanukkah gelt, my Hanukkah money, to the refugees who had nothing. And then, oh, wouldn't you know it? The new Laurel and Hardy film came to town, and I just had to see it. I went to my aunt's gourmet grocery store to ask her for the money so I could go see the movie. When I walked in, there was an elegantly dressed man with strange slanted eyes. I'd never met a Japanese man before. But I looked at his eyes. His eyes were kind and very gentle. And when I explained to my aunt what I needed, he reached into his pocket and said, yeah, take it. And he offered me a coin. I said, no, I cannot accept money from you. You are not family.
Well, for the holidays, why don't you just consider me to be your uncle?
I took the coin. Well, thank you, Uncle. My name is Solly Ganor.
My name is Chione Sugihara.
Chione Sugihara, he was the consul for Japan in Kaunas, Lithuania. And that weekend, I invited him and his wife to my house. They had never been to a Hanukkah celebration before. And there they met some of the Polish refugees. And they told him what happened to Jews captured by the Nazis. Well, time went on. And Sugihara eventually became that man who wrote thousands of these transit visas to allow the Polish Jews to escape the Nazis. My family and I, we received some of Sugihara's visas, but we waited too long. The Nazis invaded Lithuania in June of 1941. My whole family, we were rounded up and we were sent to a ghetto. And eventually, we were all split up. And I was sent to Bavaria, in southern Germany, near Munich, to a little town called Dachau. There, I witnessed terrible things. But I survived. And in the winter of 1945, in the middle of the night, all the SS guards, they came and they rousted us out of our barracks and they forced us to march off into the frozen night. We marched and we marched and we marched. For 6 days, we kept marching. Until I got so weak and so tired that I just collapsed in a snowbank at the side of the road. And the guard just kind of left me to die. And I was drifting away. And suddenly I felt myself being pulled out of the snow. And I opened my eyes and I looked into a stranger's face. He had strange, slanted eyes, like Sugihara's. And I looked around. There were four of them. They were dirty, they were unshaven, dressed in khaki uniforms. And although they were speaking English, I knew they were Japanese. And I thought, oh, they're here to kill me. And by then, I just didn't care. Go ahead. Get it over with. Kill me. And the man looked shocked. He looked at me and said, no, boy. We're not here to kill you. You're going to be fine. No. You're Japanese. You're here to kill me. I said, no, we're Japanese Americans. We're not here to kill you. Yes, you are. We went back and forth. Till finally, this man fell down on his knees, weeping. You free now, boy. We are Japanese Americans. You're free. And I looked into this man's red eyes. They were kind and they're filling with tears. And it was only then that I believed. His name was Clarence Matsumura. And he was part of the 522nd Artillery Battalion attached to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the all-Japanese-American unit. They were amongst the first people to be wandering around the whole complex of camps that fed into Dachau. I was surprised, kind of thought it was ironic that Clarence and the rest of his kinsmen were willing to volunteer to fight and die for the United States while they had their families and friends all in American relocation centers. After the war, I immigrated to Israel, and I rarely spoke about my war experience except to other survivors of the camps. And since the war, I'd never cried. A psychiatrist told me that all the horrors I'd seen in the Holocaust had dried up my tears. And now I was an emotional amputee and I would never cry again. In 1992, a historian from America, Eric Saul from San Francisco, he gave me a call and said that he was with some members of the 522nd Artillery Battalion who had come from Hawaii and California, and they were there to be honored by the Knesset. Would I come and meet them? So I came, I went to the hotel, and there they were, a small group of Japanese men in this early 70s, gray hair. And they asked me to read an account that I had written about when I had encountered members of their battalion. And as I began to read, we were joined by another man, gray hair, glasses, Japanese. And as I was reading, I got to the point where I met those four men of the 522nd pulling me out of the snowbank. And I looked at the newcomer. There were tears coming down his face. And suddenly, I couldn't go on. I couldn't speak. After suppressing the unsuppressible for years and years, I was suddenly hit with this tidal wave of emotion. And I began to weep. The little boy inside of me who I'd hidden away all these years had come out of hiding. And he was he who was weeping. All these old men gathered around me to comfort me. No, be ashamed. You are among friends. It was the voice of the newcomer. Solly, this is Clarence Matsumura. I looked at this old man, gray hair, glasses. How could it be? I couldn't tell. And then he smiled. Oh, nothing could change that smile. Oh, we fell into each other's arms. And the years melted away. And I was weak. And he held me up. Just as he did 47 years ago on the road to Valkirken, just south of a little town called Dachau.
That was Alton Takeyama Chung with a story called The Twice Saved Life. You know, on the Appleseed, we often say that we hope the stories that we bring you on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people you love. And it's difficult after a story of Holocaust survival to be too cavalier in saying, that reminds me of such and such from my own life. Because, of course, the things to which the survivors of the Holocaust were subjected really don't have an analog in the lives of most of us. It seems important to acknowledge that here. But the story Alton shared with us is, at least partly, about a story coming back around to bless the life of someone long after the lived experience that created the story. And in ways that seem very small in the face of Sally Ganor's story, but that are significant to me, I've experienced that phenomenon. Maybe you have too. Years ago, when I was a much younger guy, living on my own, I moved from the rental home I was living in to a humble little basement apartment in a town about 50 miles away. I was to begin a new job there. I didn't have much money, I was far from family, and I didn't have any help to make the move. And I loaded up a borrowed pickup truck with as much as it could carry in the middle of winter and drove in trip after trip the 50 miles to my new home. And I got sick doing it. I wore myself right out. And the last thing to move was a big old piano that I loved. Not valuable particularly, not in great shape, but very meaningful to me. I played it every day. It was the source of music in my home. And sick as I was, and alone as I was, I couldn't figure out how to get that old piano to my new home. And fretting about it among the stacks of boxes in my new apartment just made me sicker. And the doorbell rang. And it was a member of the lay clergy in my church congregation from my old place. He and his brother, without being asked, had gone to my old house, loaded up my piano, and driven it the 50 miles to my new home. And as I watched, they loaded that piano into my apartment. And then they drove off into the night. I don't know if that sounds like a big deal as I tell you that story, but it meant the world to me. It recharged my spirit when my body was under the weather, gave me hope and courage and a feeling like I wasn't alone in the face of beginning a new chapter in my life. Well, I kept that story close to my heart for a long time, years. And then more than a decade later, a decade after it happened, I had to call a big office building in my old town on business of one sort or another. I was transferred from extension to extension until I got the right manager. And as we started talking, I realized that it was that guy, that member of the lay clergy of my old church congregation. Matt Heiss is his name, a name I'll always remember. And the business I had called about faded away from both of us as we remembered together that winter evening a decade ago. And I got to thank him. I got to tell him what that experience had meant to me. And sharing it with him, even so many years later, filled me with some of the same feelings I'd had the night it had happened. I was filled with courage and thankfulness and a feeling like I wasn't alone. And as Mr. Heiss and I spoke, I learned that I had caught him on his very last day of work before retiring. Had I called on any other day after the day I called, his desk would have been occupied by someone else, his phone answered by someone I didn't know. It was a little miraculous grace that allowed an old story to come back to me years after the experiences that had created it, filled with healing and comfort and light. Mine was a soul twice blessed by the good and kind service of Matt Heiss and his brother. And that's where Alton's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? And we're so glad to have you with us today on the Appleseed Podcast. Just as Solly Gunnor's wartime wounds began to heal when the story of his experiences came back to him later in his life, our next story is about a young boy with a deep hurt. He's grieving the loss of his father. And it's about how the learning and sharing of stories begins to heal him. This is a very old magical story from the Haudenosaunee, the Confederacy of First Nations people from the northeastern part of what is now the United States. And we think you'll love it. The story is told to us by the great storyteller Dovey Thomason. And it's called The Story Stone.
The first story I want to tell you is the first story I ever heard or learned or have gifted to me when I moved from the Midwest and the Southwest to the East Coast. And it was a story given to me by Warren Skye, who was a pine tree chief of the Haudenosaunee. And that was suddenly new territory. I was from land that looks like the land around us here. And suddenly I was in this green land of wetness and greenness, and Haudenosaunee people, unlike my own background. And so this was the first story I learned out there. There was a boy who lost his father and his mother, a husband gone. And so these two went together out into the forest to live apart from the village, a change from all the normal life. For life, she wondered, he wondered, would it ever be normal again? And so they went and they lived there. And each day, the boy went out trying to do things to please his mother. He tried to be a good hunter. He tried to make her laugh. He tried to sing. He tried to drum. He tried to do all of the things that his father had done so well. Well, the boy was only about this big, and his bow and arrow were no bigger than this. And that little one, had he the skill, would not have been able to catch much for the pot. But he tried. He only had 4 arrows with that bow his father had made for him. And he wanted to lift his mother's spirits. He wanted a smile on her face. And, oh, truly, he wanted meat in the pot. He was tired, tired, tired of bean soup. And so he went out hunting one day, and he put his arrow in his bow, and he fletched and notched it back, and he saw a squirrel, and that squirrel was mocking him, and that little boy pulled taut his arrow and let it go, and it struck the rock that the squirrel had been sitting on, and the squirrel laughed a bit before he disappeared, as squirrels laugh at us still. And the little boy went over to where his arrow had struck the rock, and now it was worse. No meat for the pot and a shattered arrow. There was no way to repair it. The boy didn't know how to make an arrow. He had 3 left. He could not take a chance on another arrow, but he could not go home, not another night until his mother, he had no food for the pot. He could not face her sorrow. He could not face the sadness. It reminded him of his own. He didn't want to think. He didn't want to feel. He didn't want to go home right then. And so the forest called him and he went walking. And as he walked in the forest, he was comforted by the songs and sounds of all our relatives, the birds, the 4-leggeds, all that move and sing in the forest, until the boy noticed that too much time had passed. Already the sun was going down, light was fading, his mother would worry. His mother did not need worry. His mother had enough burdens. She did not need worry because of him. And so he headed toward home. But the path he took him past a great stone, a huge stone, perhaps one of the oldest stones of all the stone peoples. And he walked up to that stone, and sunlight was just brushing against it. And he put his hand on that stone was warm from the sun all that day. And the boy just slid down that stone, leaned into its warmth. The comfort of it made him think of his father. This was the comfort, the strength, the warmth of leaning into his father's arms and chest. And when he thought of that, that's when the boy started to cry. He hid his tears from his mother. He did not want to make her cry. Well, perhaps he hid his tears from himself. He didn't want to cry, but now it was too late. He was leaning against that stone and he was sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And a voice said to him,
"Why are you crying?"
And the boy said, "Because my, he just, my father, and he, I just, he, until it poured out of him. It was a dam breaking. It was floodwaters that needed release, and they were released, and the boy cried and wept and, oh, was pitiful until he was out of breath. And catching his breath, the voice again said,
"What's wrong, boy? A lot of sorrow there. I heard that. Maybe a story would help. Would you like to hear a story?"
And oh, the boy, he really wanted to hear a story. His father had told such good stories, and his mother couldn't even bear to repeat the stories his father had told, and she was in no mood for telling stories herself. And the boy said, "Yes, yeah," until he suddenly wondered, who was talking to him? And he said, "Who's going to tell me this story?" And he looked about for a deep-voiced bird in the tree, a deer he did not know who had stories to tell, but no. It was the stone, that grandfather's stone, that eldest of all the stones. And the stone said,
"In the beginning time, there was no earth. There was only the sky world. The earth was a place of water, and all the creatures of the water lived upon those waters and in those waves and deep beneath. But the people lived above in the sky world. And in the center of the sky world, there was a great tree, a tree of all wisdom, all kindness, all goodness, all lessons. And that tree had four roots. White roots that stretched in each direction. And the people of the village would come to that tree and they would sit and they would sleep and they would dance and they would play and they would make baskets and they would eat and they would take into their very selves all the goodness of that tree. Well, one day, the wife of the chief of that village, a young woman expecting a child, went there as she did always because that tree was a comfort. And she thought, if I am to have a baby, let it learn from this tree. Let me learn from this tree that I teach my baby well. And she leaned against that tree, and not long she fell asleep. And in her dream, she heard a scream and a cry and a moan and a yell, a howl of despair, of fear, of anger, of rage. She didn't understand such terrible voices. And in the dream, the tree was fallen over. The roots pointing up and down, and it was chaos everywhere. The people screaming around. There was a gaping hole in her world, and she woke up with a start, and the tree was above her. All was well. And that night, she told her husband of the story. She told him of the dream she had, and he said, "Whoa, I don't think I like that. I don't want you upset. Is it a good idea for you to go to that tree? Maybe you want to stay home tomorrow. Maybe you don't want to go to the tree."
And she said, "Husband, it was a dream. This is the tree of all goodness. No, husband, it was a dream. Do not worry about me." And he said,
"Oh, do not worry about you. Of course. Right. Good. Thank you."
And so the next day she didn't tell him she was going to the tree, but she did. And she went to the tree and she leaned against the tree and she thought, "I will not dream that dream." But as soon as she fell asleep, she heard a scream and she dreamt that dream. Roots up, down, here, branches gone, tumbled, a gaping hole in her world, and all the people screaming with fright. That night, she didn't tell her husband what had happened. That night, she lay down beside him in bed and she drifted off to sleep in her own bed, in the safety of her own husband, right there in her own home. And a terrible dream came, an awful dream, a scream, a yell. And she got up and slipped out of the bed quietly. She woke more easily than her husband, for when she woke, she heard screams still, though she was now awake. She went to the center of the village, and she saw a white root pointing up, and another in that direction, another down, and people screaming and crying, wakened from their beds, all come one after another to a gaping hole in their world. She leaned over that hole. She was great with child. She lost her balance, and as she started to fall, she grabbed at the roots. She grabbed for a stem of a branch of a grass, and still she tumbled through that hole in the sky world, falling through the sky. Now, far, far below in the sea, there was a great turtle, and he rose up to the water as if he knew she was coming. She looked like a shooting star coming across the sky, and that turtle said, "Someone is coming. Fast. Needing help." Now the geese are the ones. The geese, the two of them, linked their wings together, and beating their wings against the air, they lifted up. They lifted up. And when they put their wings together, they caught her just in time. And one of the geese said, "She's heavy." And the other goose said, "She's about to have a child. We better get her to ground. We'll take her to the turtle. The turtle, we will put her on the turtle's back." And he said, "Well, how will, we just have to land. She's heavy." And so the geese came closer, and the turtle saw them coming closer and said, "Beneath the sea, there is earth. Far beneath the sea, you will find earth. Dive deeply. Get earth. Put it on my back." And one by one, they tried. And I could name all the creatures who tried, but we would be here late into the night. One by one they tried, one by one they failed, until little Mother Muskrat tried. She was very small, but she was a mother, and she knew it was a mother coming, and she said, "If I die, I will help this mother." And she started to dive, and she thought she would die. She felt like her heart would explode, like her lungs would burst, until at last her paws touched something soft. And with her other paw, she struck the water and started to come up higher and higher. She grabbed hold of that turtle shell with her claws, slapped that mud on the turtle's back. And to this day, turtles have the marks of claws at the end of their shells to remind us. It was a muskrat who saved that woman, and mothers are fierce. She slapped that mud on the turtle's back, and not a moment too soon, the geese were exhausted. They put that woman down on the earth, and she did what any woman would do. Women of most traditions, but certainly among the Haudenosaunee, she began to dance. And her dance was a prayer of gratitude. And her feet did not move, did not leave the earth. She danced as people dance still in the longhouses of Canada, dances they have taught me, where your feet stay on the earth and the women shuffle. With each movement, they give gratitude. When the women are dancing like that, the men stand up and take off their hats. And so she danced, and as she danced gratitude. She danced about her baby. She danced about the future. She danced and danced and danced, and she danced valleys, and she danced mountains, and she danced hills, and she danced prairies. And at last she saw she had danced enough earth from that small gift of mud for many generations. And she relaxed. And when she relaxed, she unclenched her hands, and leaves and seeds and roots tumbled from that sky world through her hands to the earth and began to grow. And so life began on this place, this earth on Turtle's back. To this day, many people call Turtle Island. The old stone finished that story, and the boy, oh, he looked as happy as some of you. The boy just was smiling, and he stood up and he said, "I better get home. My mother will be worried." And the old stone said, "Tell your mother the story. It puts nothing in the pot, but you don't notice the hunger as much." And so the boy went home, and as he was telling his mother the story, he realized he had forgotten to do something very important. The next day, he went right back to that stone, and he said, "You gave me a gift. I was taught a gift for a gift. I gave you nothing. I brought you some bean soup." And he put the bean soup on the stone, and the stone said, "Thank you for the thought and the knowing, a gift for a gift. Would you like another story?" And so he told the boy another story. And that day, the boy stood up and he reached down into a pouch at his waist, and he took out an arrowhead, the broken shaft of the arrow his father had made for him, and he put it on that stone. That stone was a comfort, oh, much like a father to him now. And he said, a gift for a gift, uncle. And the old stone smiled, as stones can smile. And the boy went home and he told his mother that story. And that night, the mother smiled a bit. The boy saw it. She smiled a bit. She did not sigh as much. And the boy felt that it was better than if he'd gotten meat for the pot. But the next day, he went hunting. The next day, he got a rabbit. But before he went home, he stopped by that stone. He took a piece of the fur of that rabbit and put it on that old stone and said, a gift for a gift, grandfather. And the stone told him a story, a gift for a gift. And the boy went home and told his mother that story, and there was meat in the pot. And the mother was cooking, and as she's cooking, something in her was healing and feeling better, feeling stronger. She was caring for her son, and she was doing as she knew to do in her home, by her fire, with her son. And so it went. That boy grew to be a young man, growing tall, and still he went to that stone every day. Still he was given a story every day. Still, he left a gift every day until he was a man full grown, and still he went to that stone every day. Still, he brought a gift every day. The gifts were greater. The stories as welcome. Until he was a man full grown with a child of his own, a son of his own. And one day he walked into the forest. He went to that stone and he said, greetings, grandfather. And the stone said,
greetings, boy, who is a man. Who has a boy? May I tell you both a story?
And the boy who was a man who had a boy said, yes, please. And the boy who was but a boy said, yeah. After looking at his father, he leaned in to the warmth of his father. And his father put his arms around him. And then his father leaned in to the warmth of that great old stone. And that stone told him a story. And when he was done, the stone said,
that is the last story. I have told you all the stories I have heard through snows and winds and rains. I have told you all the stories I have learned through mountains run down to hills. I have told you all the stories I have known for generations. And now they're in you. And now you have a boy. Tell these stories.
And so the boy who was a man told those stories. He told them to his son till he was a man and told stories to his wife who had a daughter. And so the stories came down until they became told to me by Warren Skye of the Haudenosaunee. And now I've told them to you. And so the stories live. Thank you.
That was Dovey Thomason with a story called The Story Stone. Have you ever been unexpectedly comforted by a story? Has an old experience come back to you much later and taught you something or blessed you in some way? Is there someone who gave you important help that you want to remember? Is that a person you can reach out to? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them on the show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. We want to thank Alton Takeyama Chung and Dovey Thomason for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. While you're waiting for the next Appleseed episode, try Kaboom, another BYU radio podcast. It's filled with audio adventures for everyone in your family to enjoy, wherever you get your podcasts.